A national university education is all about opportunity. Named a Money Magazine Best Value College, with over 100 degree programs online or on campus, and one course per month classes, you can get started sooner and finish faster and begin leaving your mark on the world. National University. Visit nu.edu to learn more and get started.
Fios is not cable. We're wired differently, which means you can get the fastest internet available with equal upload and download speeds from 50 to 500 megs. So you can upload 200 photos before your favorite song is finished. Click the ad and switch to Fios today to get our best offer ever.
Blog Talk Radio.
A national university education is all about opportunity. Named a Money Magazine Best Value College, with over 100 degree programs online or on campus, and one course per month classes, you can get started sooner and finish faster and begin leaving your mark on the world. National University. Visit nu.edu to learn more and get started.
Fios is not cable. We're wired differently, which means you can get the fastest internet available with equal upload and download speeds from 50 to 500 megs. So you can upload 200 photos before your favorite song is finished. Click the ad and switch to Fios today to get our best offer ever.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, welcome. This is syndicated columnist Amy Elcon with Advice Goddess Radio, Nerve Your Way to a Better Life with the Best Brains in Science. My guest tonight is the inspiring Dr. Temple Grandin, best-selling author, autism expert, and consultant to the livestock industry on animal behavior, and she'll be discussing her fascinating new book, The Autistic Brain, Thinking Across the Spectrum, which she co-authored with science writer Richard Panik. Now, tonight's show isn't just for people who have friends or children with autism or autism spectrum disorders like ADHD or Asperger's. Stay with us and you'll hear compelling thinking on intelligence, creativity, and differences between brains and how to help people use their brains and talents in optimal ways. Hello, Temple.
Hello. Great to be here.
I'm thrilled you're here. Now, let's just start. Can you tell us about your background from childhood, back when your mother noticed the symptoms that we would now label autistic, like destructive behavior, inability to speak, sensitivity to physical contact, things like that?
Well, when I was a little kid, I had no language. I was born in 1947, so doctors didn't know much about autism, but I had no language. I was sitting and rocking. Fortunately, my mother took me to a neurologist, so I didn't get into all the psychoanalytic kind of BS. And she got me in, the neurologist recommended a little speech therapy school that some teachers taught out of their home. And they did a lot of the same therapies that are done today, a lot of intensive one-on-one teaching. And she hired a nanny who worked with me doing constant turn-taking games. I was mainstreamed into a small, normal school. Teenage years were horrible, teased and teased and teased. A regular high school definitely did not work. Ended up going to a boarding school for gifted kids with problems. And for the first 2 years, I did zero studying, but I learned how to work. I cleaned a lot of horse stalls. And when I was 13, my mother got me a little sewing job. And then eventually, took a long time, got my PhD, and I am now a professor of animal science at Colorado State University.
pretty amazing. Now, just to give us a little more background, can you give us a view of what's called the autism spectrum, from autism to ADHD with the things in between?
Well, autism is a very big spectrum, and it ranges from a mild Asperger type. In fact, they're going to change the diagnosis and make the mild Asperger type social communication disorder, but basically a socially awkward person, you know, with normal speech development. And Einstein would probably be labeled autistic today because he had speech delay. And then at the other end of the spectrum, you've got a person that remains nonverbal, that's very handicapped, may have other medical problems on top of being nonverbal, has problems with controlling movements. It's extremely wide spectrum, ranging from some of our brilliant scientists, musicians, and artists to people that are definitely going to have to live in a supervised living situation for the rest of their life.
And now you make it clear, look, this isn't a, you know, bowl of cherries having autism, but that there are distinct pluses to somebody's brain, that there are advantages if we look at them that way.
Well, I'm an extreme visual thinker, and I've got some big circuits in my head for visual thinking. Everything I think about is a picture. And that's helped me in my work as an industrial designer. I design livestock handling equipment. I visualize it. Another kind of mind is a mathematical thinker, which is definitely not me. And then there's people that are word thinkers. But people that get labels like autism, ADHD, dyslexia, learning problems, they often have uneven skills. They'll be good at one thing and bad at something else.
And now they aren't typical. And so just a quote from your book on something about your brain, you from pictures of your brain, which we'll get into, you say that the visual tract in your brain is huge. It's 400% of a control subject's brain. So this is an example of how we think, oh, autism disorder, but this is a wonderful thing, that part of it.
Well, that's the thing. And then there's other parts of my brain that definitely have a disorder. In my book, The Autistic Brain, there's some scans in there done at the University of Utah, and basically shows that my left parietal area is full of cerebral spinal fluid, and that kind of messed up the math department. You know, I guess that would be an abnormality. But the thing is, there's no black and white dividing line between geeks, nerds, mild autism, little mild ADHD, and being normal. It is a continuous trait. There's no black and white dividing line between normal and abnormal. It's not like having tuberculosis where you either have it or you don't.
Right, and this is a point that you make in your book, The Autistic Brain, over and over, that people assume that autism is a sort of, okay, you got it, but you say that actually there's huge variation in autistic people and what their strengths and what their weaknesses are.
Oh, absolutely. It's an extremely variable disorder, and one of the core deficits, it's being socially awkward. There's some circuits in the brain that are not wired up for reading subtle social cues. That's probably quite uniform across the mild end of the spectrum. And then you get at the more severe end of the spectrum, you've got very bad sensory problems that can be extremely variable, things like sound sensitivity, visual sensitivity problems. And in my book, The Autistic Brain, I have a whole chapter on sensory issues. And there's a huge need to do research on this, because you have a person that's sensitive to the flicker of fluorescent lights, they're not able to work in the normal office because it's flashing on and off like a strobe light.
Absolutely. And I love the point that you make about how people who have more typical systems don't understand this. I am extremely disturbed by sound. I learned a lot from your book. I have ADHD, so I'm on the autism spectrum. And these things like that where I can't listen to sports on TV ever, people screaming and the announcer screaming, it is so upsetting to me, where people think, You're just nuts, you know, and that's what it really helps to have a diagnosis of something. So it's more explained than you're just crazy and irascible.
You see, the problem is the diagnoses are not precise. It's basically, if a person shows this pattern of symptoms, we put this label on it. And basically the DMS, Diagnostic and Statistic Manual, diagnostic categories from the American Psychiatric Association, that I would say it's about half based in science, and the other half is based on doctors squabbling around the conference room tables and insurance companies squabbling. So half science and half not science.
I would say it's politics, insurance, and witchcraft. I mean, it's just so it's so amazing how there are such these diagnoses where you're supposed to fit into one category, and this is what your book.
Well, you've got too many categories. I mean, things like the social awkwardness, that is definite cluster symptoms that show up very clearly on brain scans, and actually will show up on old-fashioned fMRI scans that have been around for 15 years, and it's really ridiculous that they aren't just using that to diagnose that. And then there's other things that are much more not clear.
Yeah, I want to ask you a great explanation about structural MRI and functional, but I wanted to just ask you, this is something that a lot of people wonder about. How is a person with autism, you're talking about social awkwardness now, how is a person with autism different from a person with Asperger's?
The main difference is just severity. And if you use the old diagnostic criteria, the Asperger has no speech delay, but they're socially awkward. To be autistic, you had to have speech delay, be socially awkward, and have things like repetitive behavior and fixated interests. And when the new DSM guidelines come out the end of May, to be autistic, they've sort of muddied up the waters on the speech delay, but you have to have the social awkwardness, social communication problems in it, and have either repetitive behavior and fixated interests. And then they're making a new category, because I think they're trying to cut down on all the insurance claims and things like this, of a social communication disorder where you're socially awkward, and then they say that's not autism, which is absolute BS, because, being socially awkward, that's the core deficit in autism, and that is based in biology, and it's well-documented biology.
So how does that, if you can give us an example of how that social awkwardness manifests itself in a person with Asperger's?
Well, the person has to be taught. And I think today a lot of the Asperger-type kids have more problems because when I was raised in the 50s, I mean, kids were taught social rules in a real rigid way. You were taught to shake hands. You were taught to say please and thank you. And that's not done today. And for an Asperger kid, every social interaction, you got to teach them how to behave. You know, like I was in a store and I'd grab something off the shelf, my mother would say, you can only touch the things you're going to buy. But if I got to say please and thank you, they'd cue me. They don't naturally have eye contact. And sometimes they'll just say really rude things at work, like that's the stupidest thing that I ever saw. And I had some bosses at work that had to bluntly tell me that that was not okay. I remember one of my early jobs at the Swift plant in Arizona. I criticized a welder's welding, and I said it looked like a pigeon doo-dooed on it. It's not the way to put it. And Harley, the old engineer, the wise old engineer, and he recognized my abilities, and he pulled me into the office. And he said, we have to nip these little cancers before they metastasize. You're going up in the cafeteria right now, and you're going to apologize to Whitey for what you said. Now, I didn't go up there and tell him his welding was wonderful. But I went up there and apologized for all the rude language that used. And Harley did the right thing. And that was the perfect way to deal with a person on the autism spectrum, is you just tell them what to do. I had another boss that slammed down the deodorant, and that was shown in the HBO movie. I had a boss that actually did that, and he said, you better use the deodorant. And his secretaries took me shopping. You know, this is where, parents and bosses just have to be blunt about what's expected. Now, my mother always worked on developing my ability in art. You know, we've got to work on developing strengths. But things like a bunch of rude behavior, and I had to go up to that cafeteria and apologize to Whitey for saying the welding looked like pigeon doo-doo.
Did it hurt your feelings when you were told these things, or
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, it did hurt my feelings. But I wanted the job. And it hurt my feelings a whole lot. And it was not easy. And I think sometimes, you got to, hurt feelings a little bit. No, I hurt my feelings a whole lot, but now I thank those bosses. I thank Harley, and I thank the other boss that slammed the deodorant down.
Do you learn this stuff by memory, and do you get better at taking criticism when you realize that they aren't malevolent, that they have your best interest?
No, these people were trying to help me. Now, there were other people. I remember when I was at the Farmer Ranchman magazine, we got a new boss, and he thought it was really weird, and he was going to get rid of me. And Jackie, the nice lady that worked in the graphics design, she said, this new boss, Jim, doesn't like you. We're going to have to get together a portfolio of your work. So we got all my articles, and we pasted them in a scrapbook. And when I showed that to Jim, he goes, oh, you did all that? Maybe we'll give you a raise. So this brings up a really important thing. You need to short-circuit the interview process And the way that I sold jobs was by showing off my work. I made really good portfolios, and you sell your work in rather than yourself. So when I'd sell design jobs to major feedlots and meat plants, oh, I've had a nice brochure, and I'd have some fold-out drawings in it and pictures, and people would take one look at that and go, wow, you did that drawing? Well, we'll have you design our facilities. That's selling your work.
Yeah, I think that that is really important. People need to realize to do that. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio, Nerd Your Way to a Better Life with the Best Brains in Science. My guest tonight is Dr. Temple Grandin. She's discussing her new book, which is just fascinating. It's called The Autistic Brain, Thinking Across the Spectrum, and her co-author is science writer Richard Panik. So tell us a little bit more about the brain. And first I want you to tell us about MRIs, because there's structural MRI and functional MRI, which is the one where you can see your brain in motion.
Well, and there's also two other types. There's diffusion tensor imaging, the old technology, and then there's diffusion tensor imaging, the new technology. And there's scans in the book. Black and white pictures don't do them the best justice. There's a gorgeous, gorgeous scan picture on the USA Today website. You can type in Temple Grandin USA Today and find it. And what the way diffusion tensor imaging works is it tracks the white fibers. See, the whole middle part of your brain is interconnector circuits between different brain departments. And there's little tiny myelinated fibers that make up these interdepartmental circuits. And with the latest high-definition diffusion tensor imaging, you can track the fiber bundles throughout the brain, and you're able to tell where they intersect and where they just cross over each other. And they found out that I've got a big visual circuit. I have a problem in the circuit where you speak what you see. The bandwidth is smaller, so that's why I had trouble getting my speech out. This technology was developed by Walter Snyder at the University of Pittsburgh with a grant from the Defense Department, because they're using this to very precisely diagnose head injuries in veterans.
Now, you caution, I love this, throughout your book, it's very scientific thinking, that we need to be careful not to overgeneralize in looking for common ground among autistic brains. But that said, that you say that there are some commonalities, and so can you talk a little bit about how autistic brains are different from the neurotypical, as they're called?
Well, there's some social circuits that aren't hooked up, so they need to be just taught social skills like being in a play. Or you got to teach them social skills like to somebody from another country, you know, like gestures that would be rude in this country, another country they wouldn't even know what it meant. You've got, and you also can't be subtle when you're working with them. Develop the area of strength. That's the other thing. Other things, you'll have sensory issues, sound sensitivity, visual sensitivity problems, touch sensitivity. These are highly, highly, highly variable. You know, across the spectrum, it's extremely important that the little young kids get lots of hours of teaching. The minute you see abnormal behavior, the worst thing you can do is wait. Another really good thing to work with these autistic kids is you got to teach them turn-taking. And when I was young, that was taught with board games, card games, you know, all kinds of things where I had to take turns. And they've got to learn how to wait and take their turn.
Yeah, I think that's very important. My sister works with autistic kids, and she works with them and their parents, and that's what she teaches, is the social skills, how to help the parents teach their kids those things, and she does that because that's how people can function if they're autistic, if they don't have that naturally.
Well, you have to just teach them everything, like, okay, well, table manners. If I spun my fork around my head, my mother would say, put it back on the plate. She didn't scream no. She would give the instruction. If I reached across the table for the mashed potatoes, she'd say, ask your sister to pass it. She just would give the instruction.
And did you comply with this? Did you throw tantrums? How did you react?
Usually I did comply. The penalty for tantrum in our house was no TV for one night. And I think there's way too much video game playing. And the other thing we got to do is we got to teach kids work skills. I'm seeing too many smart kids on the spectrum graduating from college. They can't hold a job, and one of the reasons they can't hold a job is they can't get themselves up every morning and get in there and then do the work that the boss wants. You know, even the best jobs have some grunt work, and by the time I had graduated from college, I had done lots of work. I had done a sewing job for a freelance seamstress. I'd cleaned horse stalls. I built the gate that was shown in the movie. I did internships. One internship, I worked in a research lab and I had to rent my own house with another person. I worked at a summer program for kids with autism and other handicaps. I had a ton of work skills. I'd painted signs. I'd done carpentry work. You've got to learn how to do things that other people want.
Yeah, and in your book, The Autistic Brain, you're so remarkable about showing this ways for people to be practical in dealing with their autism, but also, you know, all these wonderful ways where your mother to help you learn social skills. You built things from a young age, very wonderful things, and she made you go to the lumberyard yourself. You know,
she made me go to the lumberyard myself, and when I was in fourth grade, I had a toy sewing machine, and I sewed costumes for the school play. And I love the recognition that my costumes I had sewn got seen by the whole school.
Now, I want to talk a little bit about sensory processing problem, the sensory problems autistic people have. And what so many neurotypical people don't realize is that you could be receiving the same sensory information as everybody else as an autistic person,
yes,
but have your brain interpret it totally differently. So you are tortured by stuff like the sounds, the way clothes touch you as an autistic person.
Well, it isn't just autism. Kids labeled with dyslexia, ADHD, also people with head injuries can get a lot of these same sensory problems, and they're extremely variable. When I was a young child, loud sounds hurt my ears. Now, a sound that bothers me may not bother another child. Some kids have visual processing problems, and when they go to read, they see the print jiggle on the page, and they can't tolerate fluorescent lights. But I want to make it very clear that not everybody with autism has this. Only some of them have it. And with dyslexia, there are some dyslexics that have this problem. Scratchy clothes can feel like sandpaper. I still have a problem with that. I've got to have soft things against my skin. And so if you have the visual processing problem, one simple thing you can do is put an incandescent lamp next to your desk, experiment with putting your reading matter on different pastel-colored papers, experiment with the computer backgrounds, make sure that you only use tablets and laptops because the other screens flicker, and you might try the Erlen colored lenses or just experiment with some various tinted pale sunglasses, and nobody really knows why they work, but some people, this is a simple intervention that can really make a difference.
And you say that researchers may not understand the urgency of this problem. It's not studied enough. What it's like to have, you know, scratching clothes make you feel like you're on fire or have a siren.
Well, just imagine if I took a heavy grit sandpaper and I put it in your underwear and you had to wear it all day.
Right. And so, but people don't realize that. And you talk about, there's something called theory of mind, and that's the ability to look at the world through another person's point of view and estimate what their response would be. And you say that, you know, people talk about how autistic people seem to not have that, but I love you say that. Researchers seem to lack a theory of brain, the ability to look through the world through an autistic person's jumble of neuron misfires.
No, they don't. And the sensory issues are not getting researched enough. We got lots of research on the problems with face recognition, problems with recognizing, you know, emotion and faces. That's been researched to death on an older type functional MRI, and which could be easily used for diagnosis for that particular problem. And for every paper they got on the face recognition, probably for every 100 papers you got on the face recognition, you probably got one paper on sensory. And the thing is some of these sensory problems are so debilitating that the person can't stand a normal, noisy restaurant. They can't stand being in an office with fluorescent lights. I mean, you're talking about sensory issues that can be very debilitating. But then there's other individuals where the sensory problems are mild. My sensory issues now, I mean, I just have to wear soft things against my skin, and the sound sensitivity problem is just a nuisance for me now. And a lot of this has been damped down since I've been on antidepressant drugs for over 30 years, and those have stopped my constant anxiety. And one of the brain scans showed that my fear center was 3 times larger than normal, but I want to emphasize that's not in everybody with autism.
Yeah, I think that's very important. But I learned so much because you keep emphasizing this, but you also talk about some commonalities, and you talk about things. I was very touched by the idea of two selves. It was so, it was very moving to read about.
Well, that was in with Tito, the very severe sensory problems in a nonverbal person with autism who types independently.
Yeah, you talked about he has the acting self and the thinking self, and you wrote that the acting self runs around the library flapping his arms, and the thinking self observes the acting self running around the library flapping his arms. And the people tend to assume that there's not something going on in the person's head, but it's just not. Sometimes it's locked in.
Yeah, it's like a person with locked-in syndrome, and he looks very low-functioning, but he's actually got a good brain inside there. He can do one sentence at a time before he has to run around and flap to calm down, and types completely independently. And when I first met him, I wanted to test him with something that his mother couldn't possibly have cued him on. And we went in this library, and I dug to the bottom of a pile of old Scientific Americans, and I found a picture of an astronaut on a horse. And I showed that to Tito, and I said, tell me about this picture. And he types really fast, Apollo 11 on a horse. And then he jumps up and runs around and flaps.
I love that. And just to get back to the intelligence being underestimated in autistics, you write about Michelle Dawson, she's a University of Montreal autism researcher who has autism herself. And you said that her autism research focused on what's wrong, and that she realized that even when an autistic person exhibits characteristics that we would call strengths, that if they belong to a normal person, we still see those strengths as sort of the fortunate byproducts of bad
wiring.
Well,
the problem is that I'm seeing too many kids becoming the label, especially on the mild end of the spectrum. I'm seeing some getting all hung up. Autism is the only thing they think about. You know, there's no expectations for behavior. This is what makes me really crazy is I go back and forth between the cattle world and the autism world. Is I go and I find an old gray-haired hippie that runs a maintenance shop at a meatpacking plant. Well, he's been there all along. He's as Asperger as he can be, or a weird guy that fixes the copiers, you know, and they're older, they're undiagnosed, or you go out to Silicon Valley. I mean, half the people that work at those companies are on the spectrum, and they avoid the labels like the plague. And then I see a 9-year-old, 10-year-old junior come up to me at an autism meeting. All he wants to do is tell me about his autism, and he's being coddled too much. He's not learning how to order food at McDonald's. It's just ridiculous, the amount of young kids that come up to me, highly verbal. They don't know how to shake hands. They grab me in inappropriate ways. They just haven't been taught.
Yeah, and I was very struck by how loving but very firm your mother was with you. I want to do a little station ID. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. My guest tonight is Dr. Temple Grandin. She's discussing her book, which is fascinating, her new book, The Autistic Brain, Thinking Across the Spectrum, co-authored with science writer Richard Panik. I just want to tell people so they can buy your book because I love it. And I think that that's very important, the way your mother is your teacher, that people were, not everybody, I'm sure, loving and firm. They didn't let you get away with stuff.
Well, what I tell parents and teachers is we got to stretch these kids. You got to stretch them just outside the comfort zone. And I like visual analogies. You can't throw them in the deep end of the pool. That does not work. You can't just do a sudden surprise, like if they're going to be going to a new school, visiting the web page and things like that would be the bare minimum that you should be doing. When I went out to my aunt's ranch, I was afraid to go, and mother gave me a choice of 1 week or all summer, and I had pictures of the ranch, and I had talked to Ann on the phone. So it wasn't a surprise. You can't spring a surprise on them. That causes panic.
Yeah, and you're great about that, about showing the ways to lead people into things. And you say that autism, you know, you're not saying it's a great thing, but that people should sit down and celebrate, their strengths, but that by looking on a case-by-case basis and recognizing where they're strong, they can direct themselves in ways where they're going to be benefiting from something.
But
they're
then take the thing the kid's fixated on and broaden it out, like the kid likes airplanes, well, then let's read about airplanes. Let's do math with airplanes. You know, let's use that fixation, you know, to teach. The other thing I feel very strongly about is kids have got to learn work skills. And I think that needs to start around age 13, you know, and I wish paper routes still existed. And they don't exist, but, you know, kids could walk dogs every day for somebody. And parents need to set these things up or maybe be a tour guide at a local museum. They'll often take 13-year-olds. And then somebody has to teach the child, no, don't stand too close to the clients, only approach them no more than twice, don't follow them around the museum. You know, when they make social mistakes, then somebody's got to just demonstrate to them, well, look at how Sally approaches visitors. Well, do it more the way Sally does it.
Yeah, it's very important. You write about that a lot. And also, I liked how you talked about how parents can go the wrong way, that you had this discussion with a parent whose fourth grader was exceptional in art, and the school wanted to discourage him from drawing all the time because they thought his devotion to drawing was, quote, unquote, not normal. And you said, look, he's a picture thinker. Work with it.
That's right. And then you've got other kids that are mathematics mind. You might have a little third grader who's a little genius in math, but he's going to have trouble with reading. That tends to be the pattern. And in my book, The Autistic Brain, we have scientific research in there that documents that the object-realistic visual thinker like me and the mathematical thinker are two different types of visual-spatial thinking. And there's actual PET scan data. That's another type of scanning that's falling out of favor now because it involves radiation, which the MRIs do not. Some MRI studies demonstrated very clearly that different parts of the brain are turned on for those different kinds of thinking.
Now, I just want to describe, I have this young friend, Sebastian, who is an autistic savant, so he's very gifted. He has all the challenges. He walked on his tippy toes, didn't really know how to sit at the table. But at around age 6, he hoovered up into his head what a book is. And when I say that, I mean down to the ISBN code, the price tagged acknowledgments. He created a book with every single thing that is in a real book, including the copyright and all that other stuff. And it had the best knowledge on dinosaurs that you will find from anybody, adult or child, like things you hadn't heard of. And you talk about how people with autism are really great at seeing details. It's a great quote in your book. That when a person with autism walks into a room, the first thing they see is the stain on the coffee table and the floorboards. You know, and you say it seems like an exaggeration, but this idea is on the right track.
But that's seeing detail. And that helped me in my work with livestock, because when I first started working with livestock and I'd done a lot of work with improving slaughter plants, and people asked, well, the cows know they're going to get slaughtered. Well, I observed they behave exactly the same way at a slaughterhouse as they behave in the veterinary chute. And they're afraid of a lot of stuff that we don't notice, like a reflection on the floor, a piece of chain hanging down. And I've been training my students to be more observant. And I have to give them checklists, verbal checklists for these things. Otherwise, I'd say over half my students can't find these things unless they have a verbal checklist.
This is just such a great thing about your book that you show, look, okay, yeah, there are these problems, but here's how we make this work. And you say traditionally researchers have characterized this trait of seeing detail as quote-unquote, weak central coherence, you know, where you can't see the big picture. But, I mean, to have somebody who's that detail-oriented, that's a wonderful
thing. Well, one of the things that helps them to see the big picture is, you see, autistic thinking's bottom-up thinking. And this goes across everybody on the spectrum. What bottom-up thinking is, you take details and put them together like puzzle pieces to make holes. So we got to get these kids out doing a lot of stuff to fill the Internet up with a whole lot of specific pictures. Like if you want to teach the kid position words like up and down, you've got to use lots of specific examples. I skied down the hill. I went down off the ladder. A plane went down and landed. I sat down on a chair. I put a cup down. You've got to use a bunch of different examples like that to teach the concept of down.
Yeah, it's very important to recognize that those things can be done, and to recognize. So you talk about some of the other deficits with the other side of things. You say that people with autism are better at seeing pure pattern rather than social pattern. So what does that mean?
Well, they're going to be doing really well on a test like the Raven's Progressive Matrices, where you're looking at differences in patterns. You know, or social cues would be things like the person's rolling their eyes because you just talked about airplanes now 5 times in a row. People are sick of it. You know,
okay,
that's subtle social cues.
An example actually you gave that was good, Peter Hobson at the Institute of Psychiatry in London in the 80s did studies, I love this, that kids with autism were asked to sort photographs according to facial expressions, happy or sad, or type of hat, floppy or woolen. You say the hat's won. And that
yep.
Kids with autism have trouble putting the pieces of a face together into an interpretation of facial emotion. So talk about
dogs categorize things like that. Betsy, my agent, has a little dog that's terrified of men wearing baseball hats. You know, if the man takes the baseball hat off, then he's okay. But with baseball hats, you can't get near this dog. Because somebody did something bad to the dog while wearing a baseball hat, and the dog cued into that feature of the man.
So, but
especially
why,
a man wearing a baseball hat.
Why do autistic people have the trouble reading facial emotions? Is that
well, there's
that,
just circuits in the brain that just are not hooked up. And that's actually well documented, and those scans have been done on me, and I came up with a typical result. So they're done with older type functional MRI.
But on the other hand, you say you can see, you know, a paper cup, you know, that's going to disturb the cattle from across a ranch, you know, and while you don't see the other, some of the social things that a neurotypical person would see.
Well, and I'm learning how to see them now. But it might have almost helped me because when I was trying to break into the man's world back in the 70s, if the cowboys rolled their eyes and I came in the feed yard, you know, as long as they didn't throw me out, I was fine. I didn't pick up the subtle cues. Maybe it's a good thing.
Right. Now, how do you learn that? Is it just
they
memory?
Have to be taught. I didn't even know that people had these little subtle eye signals until I read about them in a book when I was 50.
Wow.
You know, you have to just see, now there's so many materials now to learn stuff. But when I was a little kid, none of these things, the materials existed. There's all kinds of books and stuff you can get now to teach kids facial expressions. You can just look that up on the internet and get that stuff.
And now one of the positives that you say for your brain, and probably a lot of autistic people's brains, but again, not all, is associative thinking. You say your brain works like a search engine, and you write about walking through the United Airlines terminal in Chicago, and you associated all these things, like the Crystal Palace from World's Fair.
I could either go into, in the autistic brain book, I'm looking at the United Concourse B, it's got that glass curved roof. And then I got to thinking about other things with similar roofs, like the biosphere in Arizona and the old Crystal Palace at that old ancient World's Fair. Or I could get into an airport category and start seeing a Dallas airport, the Minneapolis airport, LaGuardia airport. You know, then if I'm thinking about LaGuardia airport, okay, now I'm seeing metal, you know, kind of a grillwork welding of apples at the parking garage. I don't know why I think I'm thinking of that because I just saw that the other day.
And so this leads to some positives. You say that you will look at usual materials and imagine a potential application or construction that won't occur to most people. Your brain sort of leaps off.
Well, I'm worried in our educational system with all the emphasis on STEM and math that, you know, they'll be locking my kind of visual thinker out from science. But you need my kind of visual thinker because I'm the methods police. I'm the one that goes, wait a minute. You didn't tell me what breed of pig you used in that study. That's totally going to change the results. They needed me on the design team for the Fukushima nuclear power plant because there's no way I would have put those emergency generators for those cooling pumps in a non-waterproof basement.
Yeah,
and when the tsunami came in there, drowned the generators.
And this is such a wonderful thing about autistic brains, and again, not at all, but you write about yourself and about Michelle Dawson that you are bottom-up thinkers as opposed to top-down thinkers, so you're more likely to weed out the unscientific, irrational stuff.
Well, let's look at another mess, the Dreamliner and the batteries burning up. Have you read about that?
Yes.
Well, they did a risk analysis where they only did it on a plane that had perfect battery with no defects, which was absolute BS. These batteries are very prone to damage. You can look that up on the internet. And their risk analysis was very much just stayed inside the airplane in a very mathematical sort of way, but they didn't look at other associated things that should have been in the risk analysis, like how about three cargo planes that burned up hauling lithium-ion computer batteries? Total loss of aircraft on all three of them. The crews were killed in two of them.
I was very amused because this is sort of a similarity that I have. You wrote about how, especially when you first started out doing your research, that you had huge amounts of information, little cut-up pieces of paper to manage. How did you end up being
I don't have to cut up paper anymore. What I did when I did my very first review article, and it was on the how sensory systems interact, I took each study and I wrote on a piece of paper the bottom line of what that experiment found out. Or if it's a review article, I might have like 20 scraps of paper because it's a review article. Then I just took all these little scraps of paper, and they were numbered for each article, put them in a box, stirred them all up, and then started pasting them up on a bulletin board to see what categories they would go in. Well, now I don't have to do that anymore. That board is in my head now. But when I was in college, that's what I had to do, and I had a big 4-foot by 6-foot board. I had hundreds of little paper strips put up, and I arranged them in different categories, see how the information fell into categories.
I'm laughing because I moderate a book festival panel, and this is how I put the questions together. I cut them up on my carpet and tape them together, and then I reprint them on the computer so I don't look too crazy.
Okay, that's what, yeah.
But I have to do that because it's so hard to manage information. And one thing I loved about your book, The Autistic Brain, is you talk about collaborating with your co-writer, Richard Panik, and to work with somebody where you work with their strengths. I have an assistant.
You see, Richard's a different kind of brain than I am, and we complement each other. He's more linear than I am. He's the more mathematical brain, and then we took the tests for the different types of brains, the object picture thinker versus the more visual and space thinker. Richard aced all the visual space tests. I flunked them, and he didn't do very well on a thing called the grain test. And what that is you might say, what has, more pixels per square unit of area, a tennis racket or a grape? Well, I'm now visualizing if I took an average-sized grape and tried to shove it through the holes in the tennis racket, it would squish. So the tennis racket has more spaces per unit of area than grapes would.
Yeah, it's so important to collaborate like that and to understand. One of the things that's helped me is to understand that I can't do it all, that I have these deficits. I have people who support me. My boyfriend does. And so I realized I'm just not that great at organizing things. I get overwhelmed by information. So I have somebody highlight stuff. I do all the writing, but she highlights things to help me draw it out and see what's important.
Well, and I had, associative thinkers, Richard had organized things. And I got 100 journal articles. Well, we can't put 100 journal articles in a book chapter. So then I got to, winnow it down to, 20 or 15.
But I guess what's important is to be able to know to ask for help. This weekend, I had a problem with organization on something. So a friend who's a professor, I sent her my chapter, asked her to do me a favor and look at the organization, because if you're stuck doing things that you're simply terrible at, you talk about algebra.
There's no way. Algebra is just impossible. And one mistake that was made in my math education is it didn't go on to geometry. And I'm getting concerned on this whole math thing, in some colleges I wouldn't be able to graduate from college. So how did I graduate from college? I got to thank the math fads of the 60s, because in 66, the required math class in most colleges in the country was finite math, which was probability, matrices, and statistics. And with a ton of tutoring, I could do that. Algebra was just impossible.
Yeah, I liked how you credit your high school science teacher, who you loved, for identifying your strengths, for being so great to you, but you criticize him for making you keep it algebra.
That was a mistake. I never got to do geometry. Now, the thing Mr. Carlock did is he got me interested in science, got me interested in studying, because when I was away at the boarding school, I did zero studying, but boy, was I learning work skills. And I think the headmaster realized that that was a good thing. But what I'm seeing now is I'm seeing too many bright kids becoming a video game recluse. And one place where Mr. Patey, the headmaster, drew a line in the sand, I was not going to become a recluse in my room. And I had a tendency to do that because I was nervous. And I can remember not wanting to go to the Friday night movie night. And he wasn't going to have me up in my room for that, so he made me the projectionist.
That's so great. I want to get to more of that on education, but first, I was fascinated by your writing on autistic people and thinking in patterns. And this is so great. You wrote that somebody reviewed a previous book. Now, we're talking tonight about The Autistic Brain, Thinking Across the Spectrum, which you wrote with Richard Panik, and I'm talking to Dr. Temple Grandin. That your previous book, Thinking in Pictures, on Amazon, there was a review where somebody was pretty miffed at your notion that all...
This is mid-90s.
Right. She was miffed at your notion that all autistic people are visual and said, in fact, some autistic people have severe visual processing difficulties and are not visual at all.
Well, and then I started interviewing people about how they think, and that's when I discovered the two types of visual thinking, the object realistic like me and the mathematical kind, and then I found that there were a lot of people...
Can I slow you down? Can you just describe those two different kinds for people?
All right, let me describe the two different types of visual thinking. They are photorealistic visual thinking like me. Like if you ask me something like race cars, I start seeing pictures of them. There's no generic concept of that. I'm seeing specific pictures. And then the other kind of mind is more the pattern thinker. They think in patterns. Think extreme origami. Think organic chemistry, mathematics, computer programming. I tried computer programming. That was just hopeless. And there's been research, and it's reviewed in the Autistic Brain book, that there are two different kinds of visual thinking. The tests are in there for to kind of test yourself for the two kinds of thinking. And then the third type is a word thinker. And they're just maybe average at math, and they do not like drawing. Visual thinkers tend to be good at drawing. So people ask me, how can you tell if my kid's a visual thinker? Well, third or fourth grade, the kid's probably a pretty good artist. And by third or fourth grade, if he's a mathematics mind, he's going to be doing good in math. And don't make him do baby math. If he needs a high school math book, give him a high school math book. But those little math geniuses often need help with reading.
Yeah, and that's very important. I was very lucky, like you. My mother went to bat for me, and she went when I was in second grade and said, look, when she says she's done reading, she's done. Let her read something else. You know, and I think that's very important that parents do that.
Well, that's right. You know, if you've got a little fourth grader that's sick and tired of doing baby math, well, then get them the math book for the next grade. I'm not suggesting putting them in the next grade. Just get the next grade math book and let them just do it in class.
Yeah, and that's just such a huge problem. I have some questions I want to ask you as it relates. Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman, he's the author of this book, Ungifted. I'm going to have him on a future show. He's somebody who was declared slow learner, was in the slow learners classes, and broke out of those, and now has very creative ideas on intelligence. And he wanted to ask you, how can we redesign education to better accommodate these extreme outliers, like the kid who's doing 12th grade math in third grade?
Well, we need to realize that people are different. There's sort of a political correctness that everybody's the same, and they're not. You know, you take the kids that are more middle of the road, yeah, he might be a little bit better than math than he is in reading, but it's all within normal limits. And then you've got kids that are real outliers, and the thing that seems to be the same in all these outliers is good at one thing, really good at one thing, and they usually have a deficit in something else.
And so how much do you focus on the thing they have a deficit in? Because you felt it was a real mistake for your teacher, your science teacher you love, to focus on algebra when you
That was a mistake. That was a mistake. We should have gone to geometry. And I have talked about a lot of this in my talks, and I'm finding a lot of people come up to me afterwards and say, oh, I was one of those. Algebra was horrible. Geometry was good. And then I've had other people come up to me and they said they loved algebra and they hated geometry. But I'm finding that it's more common to find the person that was about flunking algebra but actually did quite well in geometry.
Yeah, I love geometry. And I didn't realize that maybe some classes aren't for everyone. So how do you deal with that, you know, on a level of where the kid's really not doing well in one thing, you know, because people tend to think, okay, we should just hammer you until you do it well.
Well, there's a point where you can't hammer them. I mean, I found out is my algebra department's full of cerebral spinal fluid, and I got a very bad working memory. I don't remember sequence, and I can't remember long strings of verbal information. And so when I had a job in a dairy where you had to take the equipment apart and set it up, you know, before you started milking the cows, fortunately they had a list on the wall of the steps for, you know, setting up and taking down the equipment. And if I hadn't had that list on the wall, I would have been sunk, and I would have had to have written them down on a checklist and had a card in my pocket then. I would have had to have had that. Like if I had to work at McDonald's, tear the ice cream machine down and clean it, I would have to have the steps to take it apart and the steps to put it together written down in my pocket. And then if I've done it long enough, I could get rid of that. But in the beginning, I would need that.
So you must feel much better now, though, having, you know, pictures of your brain so it explains it. And does it help you a little more when you're not good at something because you know, oh, this part of my brain is much smaller than most people's or much larger than most people's.
Well, it explains, you know, like all my fearfulness and anxiety. And I've noticed the visual thinkers tend to be more anxious than the word thinkers. It's another pattern I've noticed. I don't have any proof of that, but it's something I've observed all the zillions of conferences that I've been at. But there are things in my brain where there's definite deficits. My cerebellum's 20% smaller than normal. And that explains that when I did skiing, I could get up to the good intermediate stage, but I couldn't do the beautiful turns where I could just keep the skis together. And I had a lot of lessons, and I was highly motivated. And I used to get so frustrated with other kids at the end of one season could ski so much better than I could.
Yeah, I love that. You mentioned that a few times in your book, The Autistic Brain. I'm talking with Dr. Temple Grandin, who co-authored The Autistic Brain, Thinking Across the Spectrum, with Richard Panik, who's a science writer. It's a fascinating book.
And well, one thing I hope for this book's going to do is to help the kids that are kind of quirky and different not get locked into their labels, and I want to see these kids succeed. At The other thing is parents need to stretch them. I'm seeing too many of these kids coddled, not learning work skills. And one of the work skills you've got to learn is that there's every job, even the most great jobs, has a certain amount of grunt work. You know, I really liked the recognition I got for managing the horse barn and taking care of the horse barn, but carrying sawdust up the stairs and bushel baskets to bed the stalls was not fun. I actually kind of liked the exercise of cleaning the stalls, but carrying baskets upstairs was, that's not fun.
No, but that's so important to learn. Part of life is drudgery. My father told us,
move on.
It builds character. We weren't, I mean, the idea of saying no or staying inside didn't, it wouldn't have occurred to me any more than growing green ears and flapping my wings.
No, I mean, and the other thing you've got to learn how to do is you've got to learn how to do stuff other people want. I heard about a brilliant guy that went to a prestigious art school and did very well, and then when he got out in the workplace, he didn't want to do stupid bird videos that his employer wanted. Well, you know, sometimes you just got to do something the employer wants.
Right.
And the guy got fired for not doing videos he thought were stupid.
Right. And I really think you're right to emphasize this about people needing to not be such spoiled brats and to not raise spoiled brats, especially people who have these deficits in some areas and strengths. You know, so if you raise people who can do these jobs, you know, who can do the grunt work.
I think that I wish paper routes were still around because I think they're one of the best things for teaching the discipline of work. So I came up with dog walking. And one thing I like about that is you got to do it every day. You know, and then other things you could do, you could help out with the farmer's market. You could buy groceries for, you know, if you lived in the city, you could go and get groceries for the old lady that lives next door twice a week. You've got to do that. Be a tour guide at a museum, make PowerPoint presentations, fix computers for local businesses. And parents need to work on setting up these jobs for kids.
Yeah, they're
very important. Mother set up my sewing job I had when I was 13.
We gave my neighbors, the little children next door, the job of caring for my dog. And I think that's very important because with an animal, you can't, you know, slough off on it because...
No, you cannot.
You've got to...
No, it is a responsibility. And when I took care of the horse barn, I had to be very careful to make sure the feed box was always locked because if the horses got into the grain, they can die. And I was very careful about making sure the feed box was always closed, you know, and that's, you know, that would, because that can kill the horses. You know, there's, and I kind of, you know, it was a grown-up responsibility, and I was very careful about that. You know, and I think for a lot of these kids, walking dogs every day would be a good responsibility, and I think parents need to just work on setting things like that up. Now, obviously, you got to use some sense about what dogs they are. You know, a pair of pit bulls might not be such a good idea. you know, a pair of labs, fine. And there's a great harness you can get so they don't pull, and you put the snap on the dog's chest on a harness, and then when they pull, they turn around.
That's great. And it's so important. So you make these things work for people within their issues. And now I have another question from the cognitive psychologist, Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman. He said, what can people on the spectrum do to display the value of their strengths?
Well, I did it by a portfolio of work. Every job I ever sold, whether it was starting out with sign painting jobs, I sold by showing off pictures of my work. Now today you could put your portfolio on your phone. It could be artwork. It could be graphic design. It could be, you know, like cattle handling facilities I designed, or if you're a programmer, it could be code, it could be mathematical things, it could be, you know, some writing you've done. Basically, so, you know, when you're a nerd, you have to sell your work and not yourself. And so you make a portfolio, and don't put too much junk in it. You want to put 4 or 5 of your best things in it, so when someone looks at that, they go, wow, that's good. And then you've got to target your portfolio. Because I found in my sign painting business, when I wanted to sell a military base some signs, showing the things that I did for my aunt's third grade classroom was, that did not impress the Army guy. You know, implement dealer sign, that was appropriate to show him. You got to show the right stuff. And people put too much junk in, and they don't weed out the bad stuff. It's got to be really neatly presented. And you always have your portfolio with you.
Yeah, I think that this is very important, and I love your emphasis on people who are artistic to look for ways they can be employed and for their parents to do that and to prepare them, not just in ways where, okay, you take this type of class, but to become somebody with a character.
Well, then you also have to try to, in some cases, you know, have a boss willing to work with you. I heard about a guy the other day who was Asperger's, And he said some really, his first day of the job, he said some really rude stuff at work. And they just fired him. And what should have been done was what Harley, the engineer, did with me to make me apologize for saying the welding looked like pigeon doo-doo. What the boss should have done is hauled the guy into the office and said, you're going to have to go out there and apologize for that. And then it wouldn't have happened again. And the boss would have, should have been real blunt about it, just like Harley was. And Harley didn't yell at me. He talked very calmly that I had to apologize to Whitey, the welder, that I said that his welding looked like pigeon doo-doo.
Now, there's more knowledge now than there was back then of what autism is.
Well, Harley didn't even think about what autism was. He was an old 60-year-old plant engineer. He just thought I was kind of, you know, well, awkward and weird, and I just had to be taught, you know.
Well, what I was,
I had a lot of people like that that helped me, and one of the reasons they helped me is they recognized my ability. When I got hired in the movie, they actually combined the two bosses. They combined the farmer ranchman along with a feedlot construction guy, and I wanted the job at the feedlot construction company. And the other boss, the one that slammed the deodorant down, said, you are famous in Arizona for two things, your brains and your slob.
That's funny. Well, what I wanted to ask you, though.
Yes, and it did hurt my feelings. But you know what? I thank these guys now. I thank Harley. And I thank the boss at the feedlot company.
If someone has some issues, they get hired for a job, where do you draw the line? Do you tell them, look, I have some problems, but I'll work on it?
Well, I think it depends upon the situation. You get into the whole thing about disclosure. And I think there's some people where they need to disclose. Also maybe have other people go in and help kind of grease the skids. And then there's other people where, let's say, it's your main problem is sensory. Well, then you just tell them that fluorescent lights give you headaches or something, and I need to get away from them. If that was your main problem at work was sensory, I wouldn't tell them I had autism. I would just tell them I hate fluorescent lights. I think it kind of depends upon the situation. But then you have a guy that's already lost two jobs because of rude behavior. You know, then you do it. You need to find a boss that's willing to work with you. But we need to figure out how to make things work. I mean, I heard about another guy he got fired from a bookstore because he wouldn't wear a tie. I'm going, come on now. You can get a shirt with a really loose collar with a clip-on tie, and you won't even feel it.
Yeah. And
I wear ties, and they're not tight. You don't even know you have them on. And you know, some businessmen, like, choke themselves with their tie. Well, this kid wouldn't have had to do that, to lose a job because you couldn't figure out how to get a tie on loose enough. I'm going, let's figure out how to do stuff.
Yeah, and this is something my sister, who works with autistic kids to help them learn how to manage in life, to help their parents, she observed that you managed to make a world full of different expectations, these neurotypical expectations, work for you, although it didn't necessarily make sense or seem logical. So that seems to be a big
task. Well, that's talking in real generality. You know, I mean, what Harley, the engineer, did is he said that, you know, he made me apologize to Whitey for talking so rudely. And I didn't go up to Whitey and tell him he did good welding because his welding wasn't all that great. But I went up and apologized for the rude language I had used.
Yeah. And so there are these things that people need to do. I think you make very good points about this. I am talking with Dr. Templebran, and she is the author of The Autistic Brain, Thinking Across the Spectrum, co-authored with Richard Panik. So we're almost out of time. I just wanted to have you leave people with a final thought about basically summing up your work and the advice you have for people out there.
You get kids get a lot of labels, and don't get locked into the label. I'm seeing too many smart kids that sort of become their label, and I don't care whether it's autism, whether it's Asperger's, whether it's social communication disorder, which will be the new Asperger's, or it's dyslexia, ADHD, or learning problem, or whatever it is, or some of the worst things like oppositional defiant. We've got to work on developing strengths. We also need to teach work skills, and I think that really needs to start at around 13. You know, I wish paper routes were still around for that. Kids have got to learn the discipline of work, doing something for other people. I got social interaction through shared interests. Get kids involved in things like the school play, band, the yearbook, doing art, Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, robotics clubs, Future Farmers of America, showing chickens at 4-H, things where they can be shared interests. And the other thing they need to learn in those things, like in a robotics club, for example, you got to learn how to make a robot that doesn't assign the task that somebody else wants, because that's an important work skill. Learn how to work in a little team of, you know, two or three students making a robot to be in a contest.
Yeah.
You know, we got to start thinking about how we're going to get them employed in good jobs.
Right. So people are functional in life. Thank
That's
you so
right.
much, Temple. This has been a wonderful show. It's been wonderful information. I've been speaking with Dr. Temple Grandin, co-author with Richard Panik of The Autistic Brain, Thinking Across the Spectrum.
Fios is not cable. We're wired differently, which means you can get the fastest internet available with equal upload and download speeds from 50 to 500 megs. So you can upload 200 photos before your favorite song is finished. Click the ad and switch to Fios today to get our best offer ever. Fios is not cable. We're wired differently, which means you can get the fastest internet available with equal upload and download speeds from 50 to 500 megs. So you can upload 200 photos before your favorite song is finished. Click the ad and switch to Fios today to get our best offer ever.
Ready? Okay.
We got paper. Yes, we do. Lysol, notebooks, pencils, glue. We got crayons, every hue. School supplies for your whole crew.
Target's got everything you need to ready, set, go back to school. Ready? Okay.
We got paper. Yes, we do. Lysol, notebooks, pencils, glue. We got crayons, every hue. School supplies for your whole crew.
Target's got everything.